For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, best-selling author Susie Steiner discusses sight loss, crime writing and grumpy characters.
But also I love her more because of that. I think I feel closer to her because she's really hard work.
Former Booker Prize winner Julian Barnes explores memory and death with Robert Kirkwood.
Historians are more used to it. Historians are more used to the gaps in the evidence.
The RNIB Connect Radio book group explore Julian Barnes's book, The Sense of an Ending.
But I did want to know. I wanted to know what happened all the time.
And narrator Beverly Klein recreates the voices of the Lion's Corner House.
They were a bit more, you know, leery like that.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Susie Steiner published her first novel, Homecoming, in 2013, to much critical acclaim. A few months later, she was registered blind. It didn't stop her writing, though, and her follow-up, Missing Presumed, was a Sunday Times bestseller and a Richard and Judy Book Club best pick. It introduced the world to Detective Manon Bradshaw, a grumpy, frumpy and dogged sleuth whose success has established Susie as a top British crime writer. The second book in the series, Persons Unknown, was published simultaneously in print and audio and joins Missing Presumed in the RNIB Talking Books library. Susie has also written extensively about losing her sight to retinitis pigmentosa and its effects on her and her family. So I was delighted when she took time away from her keyboard to join me in the studio. I began by asking her about that day at Moorfields when the doctors told her that she was now a blind person. Susie, I believe that you knew that you had retinitis pigmentosa, but that the blindness came galloping up on you.
Yes, I was diagnosed when I was five because my mum was diagnosed. But I'd sort of managed with a kind of incremental loss of sight. But then there was a sharp step down when I was 40 and I went for my checkup at Moorfields and I'd been very unlucky. I developed something called a lamellar macular hole. So my retina tore in the macula, which knocked out my left eye altogether. So I had a sharp drop in my vision, which pushed me into the sort of severely sight-impaired level. Although, actually, I have my right eye is still quite good. I have good functional sight. But these steep losses, the degeneration isn't a kind of uniform curve. It goes down in horrible steps. So you stay the same for a long time and then you lose a lot. And that those losses are very hard. You sort of have to mourn it. And I really was upset by it. Because you become frightened. You think, well, when's the next... What if something happens to my right? You know, I'm then severely, you know, disabled by it.
And it must have been all the worse for having just ridden the high of the Homecoming being so well critically received and finally achieving your dream of being an author.
I don't know if that made it worse. I had the opportunity at that point to leave the office life and work at home, which made my life easier, actually. You know, I think back then I might have managed, but now I'd struggle to be in an office. And the commute. My life's easier because I'm at home. So I don't think I was sort of riding high and then the sight loss was a peg down. I think it was a peg down anyway. It was a much more serious loss than the book coming out was again, if you see what I mean.
Did you wonder whether you would be able to continue as an author?
Not then, but I do now. What's affected me more is that, you know, the ordinary process of ageing has meant that I now have trouble reading, which has nothing to do with the RP. It's just being 46. but when you're struggling with all of the rest of your sight, you know, I always used to be able to read without any assistance, you know, I wouldn't. And now I have a kind of vast collection of glasses I have reading glasses, I have computer glasses, I have television glasses, every possible distance. And so, you know, just being able to pick up a packet of food and see how long it takes to cook is a huge... I have to go into drawers and get magnifying glasses. That is a bigger... which nothing to do with the RP. This would have happened to me anyway. So that's a bigger threat, actually, strangely. Of course, if I get a big deterioration in my right eye, then yes, I'm aware I'm going to have to adjust, and that's going to affect my work. My mum, who's 75 now, has only really been severely limited in the last 5 years. So actually, we have autosomal dominant RP. It's a very slow release RP. So, you know, I'm hopeful I can carry on with enormous fonts for quite a while.
And you're a very observational writer. I mean, it really comes through, certainly in both the Manon Bradshaw detective books, the pictures you paint of the London streets and the Cambridge countryside are very vivid. Do you still go out and do your research, or do you just have a very good memory for things that you've seen in the past?
No, because I can still see. So it's not that I have no picture. It's that I'm stumbly and I struggle to get from A to B. So I still go to Huntingdon to visit the police, and I walk around my neighbourhood. So I'm not operating from memory. I'm seeing, but with greater difficulty and with more need for assistance and with a sense of vulnerability that I think people with a disability carry with them all the time, so much so that they don't notice it anymore.
Do you think that's why you've been attracted towards writing crime stories, that sense of maybe being robbed of something?
I've never thought of that. No, I don't think so, to be honest. I think what it is that I like going inside myself. So when you write, you sit in a room, a physical room, but you leave the room to go into an internal world. And what you see is what you're imagining happening in a scene. So you sort of develop an internal view. And you watch people come into a room and have a conversation, and then things happen, and you write down what you see. And in that world, I'm free. I don't have to shuffle my foot forward to find the step. I don't have to reach for the rail. I can move about without any hindrance. So I think that's what writing gives me. It gives me this freedom when the world outside is closing in.
You didn't seem to set out to be a crime writer. Homecoming was very much a family drama set mostly up in Yorkshire.
Yes, that's right.
And then to read your second novel as a crime novel came as a little bit of a surprise, a very, very pleasant surprise, I have to add. Were you a great fan of crime novels when you were growing up?
Not specifically crime, not hard-boiled. I don't read in the genre in that sort of Catholic way. Mm. But I really loved Kate Atkinson's Jackson Brodie series, which began with Case Histories. And whenever a new one came out, I bought it immediately and sort of devoured it. And for me, what she did in that series is it was this delicious combination of her literary style and the riffing and the meandering and the relationships and the dry humour with a really grippy motor. A plot that ran. And that's what I wanted. I thought that's my favourite thing to read. So something good at sentence level, something elegant, but also page turning drive. So that was my project with Missing Presumed.
You also provide a social commentary to the world around Manon and the other people in the books that I think is a hallmark of the best crime novels. I think they should comment on the world around them. Is that something that you felt strongly you should put into the book as well?
Crime does allow you this incredible freedom to talk about human beings on a sort of psychological and emotional level, but also to talk about the status quo. Crime innately is about some kind of rotten status quo that the detective either seeks to restore or to change. You know, that's the sort of innate, there's a rupture and there is a putting back together of in the puzzle. That's what crime, the structure of crime does. So it lends itself to a kind of dystopian commentary in a way, or a sense of what is rotten.
The research in your books comes across very strongly without being ladled on in trowelfuls. Is that the sort of investigative journalist in you coming through? Or?
It is. It's exactly there that journalism comes into play. And actually, I was an editor for 10 years, so I didn't do much writing. I think where my journalistic background comes in is I got in touch with the police in Cambridgeshire. I went to see them. I formed a sort of bond with one of the detectives. This is years ago now, and he advises me on everything, and I'm in contact with him a lot. I speak to him most weeks, and it's invaluable because when you're writing a scene that's very specific, so you need to ask, so if you were in a taxi rank and you needed to do this, how would you call for backup? You can't Google that. That's so specific, you can't Google it. So I couldn't in any way write these books without him. So that kind of contact making and maintaining of those relationships is journalistic for sure. And it's also a huge pleasure. You know, it's so interesting. His work is so interesting. So, yes, I think that's what carries through.
You have a very strong sense of the characters in your book. I mean, the police are very three-dimensional. They're tired, they're irritable, they're hard-working, they're trying to get their job done. Manon is a wonderfully unglamorous and sometimes rather unsympathetic detective. We're so used to reading detectives whose authors are in love with them. I find it actually rather refreshing that we're not always meant to feel sympathetic with Manon. She is grouchy.
Mm, and difficult. She's very difficult.
Where did she come from?
I think she's really me, you know. I think I can't stand characters which are idealised, you know, or which are given sort of fake flaws, like they wear quirky tights or they shop in antique shops. You know, those sorts of... I think human beings have serious flaws. You know, that's what it is to be human, is to live with one's, not pretend, but very serious shortcomings. And other people have to live with them too, and that's the most difficult thing in life. So for me, for a character to be real, they can't be sort of sweet. They've got to be difficult in a true way. But also I love her more because of that. I think I feel closer to her because she's really hard work and she does go wrong in a serious way. That involves me as an author taking a risk, because you have to risk that she won't be liked or that she'll be judged sort of harshly.
I suppose it's a trust issue, isn't it? And actually, if we trust in her abilities, then we will forgive her some of her foibles.
Yes, and also, at core, she's a good person. Mm. You know, she's not malign, she's not mean. She's essentially good.
Yes, honest to a fault,
I suppose. Yes, too honest, horribly honest.
Now, this is a rather self-indulgent question, but my favourite character in your new novel is Birdie. I loved Birdie, I think, because I've met one or two in the past. Can I ask for a small spoiler? Is she going to return in a future novel?
No.
Oh,
well,
no.
Well, at the moment, she isn't. You know, she's particular to persons unknown. I think what's difficult when you write a sequel, and it isn't as persons unknown, you can totally read on its own. You don't need to have read the first one. So buy it, folks. But when you go back to the same cast of police officers, obviously you have a history with them and you know them really well and you feel a fondness of knowing them well. So the challenge is with the new characters that come with the new crime is to create people who can stand their ground next to these beloved characters. So the new characters have to really be strong and you have to You don't want the reader to think, oh, no, we're back with Birdie. Oh. You know, I want to get back to Manon all the time. Mm, so she had to be a literally larger than life. She is larger than life. Yes, I love her too. She's enormously fat in a way that is connected to joy. You know, she loves... She says yes to life and yes to all the biscuits as well.
Well, I shall carry on getting the books in the hope that she'll make a cameo in the future. Both Missing Presumed and Persons Unknown are wonderfully read by Juanita McMahon. Did you have any hand in the choice of narrator for the book?
No, not at all.
Have you listened to them at all?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've heard the beginning page, you know, but... To be fair, I can't imagine anything worse than listening to my own book. I'd roll about squirming, thinking, oh, it's a terrible bit.
Do you listen to audiobooks in general, or are you still a print reader?
I'm still a print reader, just. You know, I find audiobooks a bit alien still, and I know that I will get there, because I will have to get there. But I experience reading as a very internal process. Mm. And so there is a disconnect with reading, hearing it aloud. And it's also written internally. You know, it's not a play. So I find that awkward. I read on Kindle in the most enormous font size.
But you must be delighted that the books have been simultaneously published in audio and in print and can reach a visually impaired audience.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a blind audience, you know. This is hugely important to me. These are people I share a massive hinterland with. So, I'm really pleased. Audiobooks are critical.
Well, thank you very much, because you have certainly brightened my last week, even if you've given me some very late nights as I've tried to read the book before talking to you. So I very much look forward. I take it you are working on a third in the Manon series?
I am working not very fast on a third in the Manon series.
Susie, thank you so much for coming into the Read On studios.
Thank you.
Crisp in one hand, sandwich in the other, the tickle and press of light internal kneading around her pelvis like butterflies in a sack. Seems typical that pregnancy has brought zero in the way of nausea, but has instead turbocharged Manon's appetite. She becomes aware of Harriet and Davy talking, urgent and low, on the other side of the open-plan office. Something's up. They're quickening. Manon elongates her neck, craning to hear, but her colleagues are too far away. As they pass her desk, she says, "Anything up?" "Job's coming," Harriet says, but it's clear she can't be bothered to fill Manon in.
"Ooh, who is it?"
Manon says, full mouth. They ignore her. She looks at Davy, full of himself these days, Detective Sergeant Davy Walker, promoted by the super, Gary Stanton. He might as well call Stanton Daddy. Well, he's welcome to it.
Juanita McMahon, reading Persons Unknown, written by my guest, Susie Steiner. Both Missing Presumed and Persons Unknown are available as talking books from the RNIB Library as TB700151 and TB701973, respectively. And they're great reads. Susie will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later, Beverly Klein on narrating wartime stories, and the RNIB Connect Radio Book Group will be discussing The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. But before that, here's another opportunity to hear the interview that Robert Kirkwood recorded with Julian Barnes about his novel The Sense of an Ending, shortly before it won the Man Booker Prize in 2011. Thanks to a long-standing agreement between RNIB and the organisers of the Man Booker Prize, all the shortlisted titles are made available in a full range of accessible formats. to users of the RNIB library. Here's a clip from the talking book version of The Sense of an Ending, narrated by Richard Morant.
I remember, in no particular order, a shiny inner wrist, steam rising from a wet sink as a hot frying pan is laughingly tossed into it, a river rushing nonsensically upstream, its wave and wash lit by half a dozen chasing torch beams. Another river, broad and grey, the direction of its flow disguised by a stiff wind exciting the surface. Bathwater, long gone cold, behind a locked door. This last isn't something I actually saw, but what you end up remembering isn't always the same as what you have witnessed.
A clip from the RNIB talking book, The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. Now, essentially, the book is about the imperfections of memory over time, but, Julian, it's actually about so much more than that.
Well, I hope so, yes. I mean, you always have to have a sort of one-line tag to describe a book. What you want is to write a book which would take as long for you to describe everything that's in it as it actually would take to read. So it's also, yes, it's about memory, it's about time. It's also, I think, principally about getting it wrong. What happens if towards the late midpoint, early ending stage of life, you realize that things you believed for a long time, 20, 30, 40 years, turn out to be perhaps completely wrong, perhaps half wrong. And that was one of the sort of starting points for the novel for me.
It's something I've certainly noticed in autobiographies. When two people are describing the same event in two different books, there can be two completely conflicting accounts of essentially the same situation.
Yes, that's true. I mean, one of my favourite quotes is an old Russian saying which goes, "He lies like an eyewitness," which I used as the epigraph of one of my novels some years ago. So it's it's the fact that eyewitnesses are unreliable. Even documents can prove to be unreliable. An awful lot goes missing. Evidence goes missing. Written evidence goes missing. People's evidence goes missing. And so whether you're a historian or a character in a novel trying to make sure that the record of your life is accurate, I think we're all in for a lot of trouble. Of course, historians are more used to it. Historians are more used to the gaps in the evidence, biographers too, and what they do with them. I mean, for instance, I have a friend who's Hermione Lee, who's currently writing the biography of Penelope Fitzgerald. And about halfway through Penelope Fitzgerald, great English novelist in my view, halfway through her life, she was living on a houseboat and it sank. It took with her all the documents of her life up till then, all the love letters from her husband and so on. Mm. And so you're suddenly faced with this enormous hole and you have to sort of patch it and weave your way across it. And I think something like that can often happen in our memory of our own lives. And then, of course, what happens in the book is that something comes along which sets you off on a course of investigation in which some of your sort of fundamental certainties about what you believed and the way that you've lived your life come under serious review.
Now, a lot of your books centre on mortality and death and getting older. Is that a subject that sort of interests you, or is it just a morbid fascination?
I don't know. I wouldn't distinguish between the two. I think I've had death in my books since my first novel. It's the thing that we all have to consider, I think, though lots of us avoid it. It's the thing that puts life in context and that makes either a sense or a nonsense of life, depending how you look at it. I think it's probably true in the last two or three books I've been looking at matters of aging and death. But then I don't think this is necessarily because they come into sharper focus for me as I get older, because I've always had a sense that death is on a sort of parallel railway track, and at some point it's just going to cross, the track's going to cross and you're going to be wiped out. So I've always had a sharp sense of it, yes. And I wrote about that in a book called Nothing to be Frightened Of about 5 years ago. But I think that I don't think my books are morbid. I think my books are lucid. And I think that a lucid looking at the darker side of life is part of what's necessary to keep you sane. I don't think running away from things or not looking at the darker side of life actually helps.
Now, The Sense of an Ending is a shorter book. Did you know it was going to be that short when you started writing it? And did you have, I hate to say it, did you have the sense of an ending to the book when you started?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. I knew what was going to happen before I started it. I generally do. I mean, I think it's, I think it would be a bit strange to set off on a journey not knowing where you want to go, though I know some writers do operate like that. And having written 10 previous novels and quite a few short stories, I have a fairly strong sense at the point at which I begin how long or concise, I would say, rather than short, the resulting text is going to be. So it didn't come in at anything longer or shorter than I expected, and I certainly think that every idea you have has its natural length when it's turned into fiction, and you shouldn't try and stretch it. If anything, you should try and make it more concise. But I couldn't make it any shorter, so that's how it's ended up at the length it does.
You have in the past campaigned against the closure of libraries, and including RNIB's Talking Books Library in this. How important are libraries to society as a whole?
Oh, I think libraries are incredibly important, and I think it's very glib to think that, oh, everything is available on the internet nowadays, and you can download a book and so on and so forth. I think both the experience of a physical book is different, and the wider social experience and values of libraries, it can't be expressed in financial terms. It's a place of interchange. It's also a place where, you know, many families don't have a book in the house, and it's a place where you can get used to reading and gain comfort and an awakening of the mind from. I think it's incredibly short-sighted of this government to effectively close down lots of libraries by putting such pressure on local councils that they take what is sometimes regarded as the easy option. It's maybe the easy short-term option, but I think it's a very, very bad long-term option.
Now, focusing on the RNIB Talking Books Library,
yes,
you have supported it in the past. I remember you coming into my old workplace in Camden, recording a short story called The Things You Know for an RNIB book called Sightlines. Why do you think it's important to support RNIB?
Oh, I've supported it for many years. Because I'm a great believer in the profession that I follow, and it would be awful for people to be deprived of the pleasures of books and fiction because of blindness. I mean, it seems to me it's a no-brainer. I don't think you'd find a writer in the country who would not fully support the RNIB and all that it does.
This is a question I meant to ask you when you were actually in Camden. England was out at the time, and I wondered if you'd ever been to the Isle of Arran in Scotland, which is described sometimes as Scotland in miniature.
I didn't realise that Arran was described as Scotland in miniature, I'm afraid. No, it was the function of my own imagination and thoughts I was having about what was happening to the idea of England, and then I looked around for a useful island, and I thought, the Isle of Wight, yes, which I have remembered from childhood holidays and so on.
Mm.
And so I stuck it there. But I'm sure a Scottish writer might want to take on the idea of what is happening to Scottish nationhood. which I think is probably more interesting than what's happening to English nationhood, because I think the Scots have always been better at defining themselves than the English have.
Now, back to the Booker Prize. This is the fourth time you've been nominated, and you are, this time, the bookie's favourite.
Well, that doesn't mean anything. I was the bookie's favourite last time as well.
But you must be hoping for a win.
Well, I'd be crazy to hope not to win it. So, of course, I hope to win, yes. I mean, this is the fourth successive decade in which I've been shortlisted. And I can tell you that I know the ins and outs of not winning pretty well by now. So anything for a change. But it's, you know, it's five people who you don't know rereading all the books maybe two or three times. And always, superstitiously, I never read the other shortlisted books. So, you know, there may be something that, truthfulness, I would admit was blazingly superior to my novel, but I jolly well hope not.
We live in time. It holds us and moulds us. But I've never felt I understood it very well. And I'm not referring to theories about how it bends and doubles back or may exist elsewhere in parallel versions. No, I mean ordinary, everyday time, which clocks and watches assure us passes regularly. Tick, tock, click, clock. Is there anything more plausible than a second hand? And yet it takes only the smallest pleasure or pain to teach us time's malleability. Some emotions speed it up, others slow it down. Occasionally it seems to go missing, until the eventual point when it really does go missing, never to return.
The Julian Barnes novels available from the RNIB Talking Books Library are Arthur and George, Before She Met Me, Cross Channel, England, England, Flaubert's Parrot, A History of the World in 10.5 chapters, The Lemon Table, Love Etc. and Metroland. For more information, contact rnib.org.uk. And Julian Barnes, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, and I hope many of you out there enjoyed my book.
Thanks to Julian Barnes and Robert Kirkwood. The Sense of an Ending is available in Braille, giant print and as TB19027. And we'll hear what the RNIB Connect Radio Book Group made of it after this.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB Library has the largest library of its kind in Europe, with over 60,000 items in the collection. You choose the books, you choose the format, and we deliver to you. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Beverly Klein on becoming a talking book narrator and the books of Susie Steiner's life. But now, here's Robert Kirkwood to introduce the RNIB Connect Radio Book Group.
Hello, I'm David.
Hello, I'm Supriya.
I'm called Peter.
Hello, I'm Peggy.
I'm Lillian.
Hello there, my name is Alan.
The Book Group on RNIB Connect Radio.
It was compelling rather than really enjoyable, I think.
Once again, I wouldn't use the word enjoy. I found it intriguing.
The group discusses The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes.
He wants to portray himself as this very affable guy, doesn't he? Yeah.
That's where I think the narrator, Richard Morant, really scores well.
You know, I think it was quite a clever twist at the end. It was, for me, I could imagine that kind of thing happening, yeah.
Here's a clip from the latest episode of The Book Group on RNIB Connect Radio.
I read the book, yes, although it was a long time ago now. I have read about 20 books since then, so my memory isn't as fresh. But I did, I wouldn't say enjoy, that's not the word. And it was an okay book. I hadn't read Julian Barnes before, so that I was quite curious to see how he writes, and I was interested. I was glad the length of the book wasn't was just right, I thought, for the story. I started to like the characters, but then I was a bit disappointed with them. I did like the main character, Tony, I think his name is.
That's right, Tony, yeah.
I thought there was a rather lot of passages devoted to what he thought or what his feelings were. But other than that, it was a fairly good book, I would say.
And Peggy, what about yourself?
I wasn't really particularly keen on it. It took a while to get into it. It's a while since I read it too. I had to go back today and look at my notes that I put in the computer about different books to remind me about it. Didn't really get terribly engrossed with any of the characters, not even the main one. And I thought it was a bit disjointed, I think. It jumped backwards and forwards. Maybe it was just my lack of concentration. But I don't think I could honestly say it ever really gripped me. I didn't not like it, but I wouldn't rave about it. It was interesting. A lot of what was in it was interesting. But as I say, I felt it was a bit jumped backwards and forwards between the characters.
And David, what about yourself?
Well, I have to say that I enjoyed the book very much. I wasn't expecting to. After the first sort of 5-10 minutes, I thought, oh, no, it's going to be one of these odd sort of psychological, arcane books that it's going to be very difficult to get to grips with. But actually, it turned out that to be the case in a sense, but I was absolutely gripped, and I loved all of the characters, really. And it's just one of those books that I couldn't not read once I'd started. I think to say that I enjoyed it was possibly misstating it a bit. It was compelling rather than really enjoyable, I think.
Alan, what about yourself?
I think, once again, I wouldn't use the word enjoy, as a couple of people have said. I found it intriguing. I found it... I could relate to it, although I didn't go to a day school. I went to a boarding school. We left school and two or three of us said, we'll keep in touch. And that was very similar to the friendships that the four of them formed. And I found that dynamic quite interesting. Yeah, I was going to say entertaining, but I'll say interesting. And one was clearly more academic than the other three, and the one who went obviously direct to Cambridge. And I also enjoyed the repartee between the boys and the teacher. I found that quite amusing in many ways. You know, getting one up on the teacher, talking on quite an intellectual level for teenage boys, especially Adrian, the boy who went to Cambridge, the clever one. I found that quite good. In fact, at one point the teacher says, one day you'll take this class, you know, so he could see potential in Adrian. I thought it was going to be a bit wordy, lots of words to get across, his point, the author, and a lot of his own philosophy in between, you know, what was the beginnings of a base of a plot or a storyline. But I did want to know. I wanted to know what happened all the time. So that brought me back to focusing and listening.
And you can hear that whole episode on our Audioboom page. There's a link on the front page of rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
Plenty of food for thought there. And we'll look forward to hearing from the Connect Radio Book Group again next month. Beverly Klein is a relative newcomer to the Talking Book Studios, but, like all the best narrators, she has a rich, versatile voice that she's honed through her career as an actor. I caught up with her during a break in recording and asked what led her to become an RNIB narrator. Beverly Klein, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
So how are you enjoying being an RNIB Talking Books narrator?
Well, it's a fascinating thing to be doing. It's wonderful, I think, to explore the skill of sight reading in the way that I am, because the various books that I've been reading, and as you say, I am new-ish to this whole experience. Sitting down at a microphone and reading for 3 hours on end is quite an extraordinary thing. You do settle into some sort of mental landscape where you find your mouth moving and you're not quite sure how you're operating this eye-to-mouth-to-head-to-ear extravaganza that you're working on. It's an interesting process.
And I know that you've played parts on TV and on the stage. How do you feel about being the entire ensemble cast for a book?
Well, the book that I started with here, I mean, I did some magazine reading for them, which is good fun, except that you do have to master an awful lot. I was doing country living. That's how I started, doing country living. And there are pictures of very attractive couples who've moved to Suffolk from West Hampstead in order to make soap from their own goat's milk. And you have to master quite a few Latin words to describe the flora and fauna of the area, and telephone numbers. That's quite a tough one. / this and that. Then when I did my first book, it was about the nippies. Your older listeners will know exactly what I'm talking about, because I knew exactly what I'm talking about. But when I've said it to younger people, they look at me blankly when I have to describe the nippies of Lion's Corner House. And that was a wonderful experience, because it was the two books in the series that I read set in wartime London. And I had to be about 15 or so different Cockney girls, trying to differentiate between them. Some of them were very quiet and talked like that, whereas others were about... That's not going to blast your... I'll move away from the microphone a little bit. They were a bit more, you know, leery like that. And then there was one who was a bit trying to be posh, but not really quite managing it like that. But then I had to do some of the men as well. And the mothers, who were a bit more... My worst experience was with the Welsh characters. I've got to admit, that's not my finest hour, the Welsh characters. I was slightly embarrassed by those. And, of course, Churchill and Chamberlain I had to impersonate at one point, doing some radio broadcasts, of course, about the war. And I've got to admit, the announcement of war... Actually, I had to stop because I was quite moved by my own Chamberlain when I said we are now at war with Germany. It was quite upsetting. But yeah, that's enormous fun, actually. And to have to, you know, go through bombings and some quite sad moments, or weddings, or little bits of sexy bits as well, which were, you know, had to keep a straight face. So yeah, that was great fun.
Well, I can't see your dad letting you leave home. Not if he won't even let you spend one night away to watch the coronation, Joe said. Well, I wouldn't exactly be sleeping on the pavements, would I? Phil grinned. Anyway, let's forget it now, Joe. I've come to enjoy myself and I'm blowed if I'm going to let anything else spoil it.
That's right, girl, said the fat woman sitting close by on a heap of cushions and a raincoat. That's what it's all about. A bit of enjoyment. That's what we all need when all's said and done, and that's what we're going to have. Here, have a Marmite sandwich. And I've got a flask of tea to keep the chill off. You can have a sup of that too.
Corner House Girls by Lillian Harry, narrated by my guest today, Beverly Klein. And the other wartime book that you've narrated was rather different, a very poignant memoir of a Holocaust survivor.
That's true, yes. Actually, now I remember, of course, that was actually the first book that I read. I don't know why they seem to have cast me in the wartime role here, because all of the books that I've read have been set during the war. And that was it was a very a short memoir of a French woman who I believe is still with us. She's very elderly, and she lived through being separated from her family, none of whom except her father were captured and in camps, but they were in separate camps. And unfortunately, she saw her father once during that experience and then never saw him again. But she did go back home to her family. I think it inevitably left her rather cold and bitter. And I say that with no judgment at all. But, you know, you do hear from people who've gone through experiences of that harrowing nature. And some of them are extraordinarily forgiving. And I always think that's quite an amazing thing to go through something like that and yet still have the gratitude and warmth and forgiveness to people. I feel that she didn't quite manage to come through in that way, but we all deal with circumstances as best we can. And as I say, I have no judgment on that whatsoever. It was a very cool and clear documentary of her experiences at the time.
It's also a reminder that the Talking Books Library isn't just full of fiction and romping good tales. It also has a very important historical section to it as well.
Absolutely. I'm currently reading a book for the RNIB about the Ravensbrück concentration camp, which has been quite harrowing just for me as a reader. And it's... you think you know about these things. You know, I've lived most of my adult life knowing the circumstances of what happened to all sorts of factions, not just the Jewish people, but to gypsies and...
And blind people as well.
And blind people, people of varying degrees of physical limitations. In fact, and tragically, I mean, those were amongst the first people to be taken and exterminated, tragically. This particular book is extremely serious. It's incredibly well-researched. And it's about the female concentration camp, of which very little has been known. And that's partly because it was in Eastern Europe, behind the Iron Curtain, as it were, because it was very near to Berlin.
And how do you go about preparing to narrate a book?
Ideally, you mark up the different characters, because sometimes a character doesn't reappear for some chapters, and if you were to come across it, you'd screech to a halt and think, oh my goodness, what sort of voice did I use for that? So you try to make a little bit of a note about, you know, whether it was that's the quiet one, I remember. So, and also with plot points, you need to have you can't be surprised yourself by the things that are occurring. With the book that I'm currently reading, to be honest, I am going through it, I'm scanning it rather than reading it carefully. A, because I have to go through it once and that's kind of enough. I mean, read through what is happening in it, because it really is quite disturbing and quite grueling. But these are stories that have to be told because they are still being denied, of course. So I'm scanning it for foreign names that either in French or German I can read those. But the Polish names I have a little bit more difficulty with, so I have to look those up. Pronunciations of various place names, and also to mark up page turns so that you're not turning a page in the middle of a sentence. But yes, so that's quite a sort of a different technique, really. To scan the page for the technical nature of it,
and bringing books to life for those of us who can't read text is obviously very important and very
much appreciated by those of us who get to listen to your voice. Do you have any friends or relatives who have lost their sight?
Oh, golly, yes. On my mother's side of the family, practically everybody had sight problems. And I myself have been very short-sighted from an early age. And I did have a bit of a problem with one of my eyes, but fortunately I'm well sighted. But my grandfather was blind, one of my mother's sisters was blind, and a cousin was blind too. So I do remember very clearly going and visiting my grandfather when he was in his 80s in a Jewish blind home in Dorking. So I'm very familiar with the experience.
Thanks to Beverly Klein. Her recordings of Lillian Harry's Corner House Girls and its sequel, Kiss the Girls Goodbye, are TB24041 and TB24042, respectively. And I'm sure we'll be hearing far more of Beverly in the future. Do you have a favourite narrator you love to curl up with? Or maybe you found a hidden gem like Corner House Girls in the library? Why not drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to Susie Steiner for the books of her life. Susie, was there a book that you read as a younger person that made you want to become a writer?
Oh, well, yes, I wanted to become a writer from about late teens, 18, you know, I was backpacking my year off and I was reading Portrait of a Lady, Henry James and George Eliot and all those terrific realist Victorian novels. But the books that really made me write Missing Presumed were Kate Atkinson's Jackson Brodie series, because I wanted to replicate this brilliant thing she did, which was the combination of literary meandering and observation and humour combined with page-turning grip. So that was my favourite. Those reads were really delicious to me and I wanted to recreate that feeling.
How lucky were they? A heat wave in the middle of the school holidays exactly where it belonged. Every morning the sun was up long before they were, making a mockery of the flimsy summer curtains that hung limply at their bedroom windows, a sun already hot and sticky with promise, before Olivia even opened her eyes. Olivia, as reliable as a rooster, always the first to wake, so that no one in the house had bothered with an alarm clock since she was born 3 years ago. Olivia, the youngest and therefore the one currently sleeping in the small back bedroom with the nursery rhyme wallpaper, a room that all of them had occupied and been ousted from in turn. Olivia, as cute as a button, they were all agreed, even Julia, who had taken a long time to get over being displaced as the baby of the family, a position she had occupied for 5 satisfying years before Olivia came along.
Kate Atkinson's Case Histories is available from the library in Braille, giant print, and as TB14091. Is there a book that you would like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day with nothing better to do?
I'm a huge fan of Elizabeth Strout, the American contemporary novelist, who was on the Booker shortlist with My Name is Lucy Barton. But my favourite of hers actually isn't Lucy Barton. It's her novel, Olive Kittredge. And the amazing thing about Olive Kittredge is the writing is very precise and quiet, but Olive is an impossible human being. She's sort of awful in lots of ways, and yet you love her so much. She's so straight and so true. So for a hugely flawed but endearing person, Olive Kittredge is a masterstroke.
Although several of Elizabeth Strout's books are available from the RNIB library in a range of accessible formats, they don't yet include Olive Kittredge. But here's a clip from My Name is Lucy Barton, which is TB23452.
There was a time, and it was many years ago now,
when I had to stay in a hospital for almost 9 weeks. This was in New York City, and at night, a view of the Chrysler Building, with its geometric brilliance of lights, was directly visible from my bed. During the day, the building's beauty receded, and gradually it became simply one more large structure against a blue sky, and all the city's buildings seemed remote, silent, far away. It was May, and then June, and I remember how I would stand and look out the window at the sidewalk below and watch the young women, my age, in their spring clothes, out on their lunch breaks. I could see their heads moving in conversation, their blouses rippling in the breeze. I thought how, when I got out of the hospital, I would never again walk down the sidewalk without giving thanks for being one of those people. And for many years I did that. I would remember the view from the hospital window and be glad for the sidewalk I was walking on.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, it's a very good whodunit, old-fashioned, well-done whodunit called The Dry by Jane Harper. It's amazingly, it's a debut, because it's, which I'm amazed by, because it's so well done. There's a murder in a sort of Australian outback town which is beset by drought, so everything is dying in this town, and everyone is a suspect, everyone's under pressure. It's a bit like Broadchurch in the way that it sort of pans around all the different suspects, and it's just a very good read.
The Dry by Jane Harper is available commercially in print, audio and ebook versions. Susie Steiner, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with me and the listeners.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.